Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Tuesday, October 29th, 2019. South Sudan's former revenue authority boss says he cannot leave the country.
There is an investigation being conducted and there is no reason for him to leave.
And a cargo plane crash lands in Bor.
The weather was really terrible. A L410 from Walgak going to Juba had crashed.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The former head of the South Sudan Revenue Authority is accusing a high-ranking government official of not allowing him to leave the country. The Ghanaian national who helped South Sudan collect millions of dollars in previously unpaid taxes is accused of diverting government money. The Suba Memo reports for VOA from Juba.
Former South Sudan Revenue Authority Chief Olympia Tipo tells South Sudan in Focus that Finance Minister Salvatore Garang, who fired him 2 months ago, is behind his confinement in Juba.
The Ministry of Finance is in charge of this, so when he formed the committee at that time, I was hoping to carry not to leave the country, and so the committee, I made the committee on two occasions, so it's only that I've not received a report yet from them on what they have seen.
Information Minister and Government Spokesman Michael McQuay says he is not aware of any travel restrictions imposed on the former Revenue Authority boss, but admits the government is investigating Atipo over unspecified issues related to revenue collection while he ran the revenue body.
Well, I'm not aware about it, but of course there is an investigation being conducted. And if there is an investigation being conducted, then there is no reason for him to leave.
Atipo's firing came a month after he revoked a huge tax exemption that Garang approved for a multi-million-dollar construction company identified as Rack Resource Group. The June 14th exemption would allow the company to import factory service equipment, medical items, fuel, agricultural items, petroleum products, construction materials, and food worth more than $491 million. After seeing comments on social media about the exemption, Atipo looked into the matter and learned Rack's tax exemption request came directly from Maik Ayi, the minister in the office of the president. His letter was addressed to the Minister of Finance. That same month, Atipo accused finance ministry officials of denying receiving cash payments from the revenue authority, saying, quote, "Some people may be eating this money, who knows," end quote. Atipo says unidentified government officials then began spreading lies about him.
There were a lot of rumors and then allegations and flying everywhere before this happened. But the truth is that all that is not true. I think basically I am no longer in office for 8 weeks now. If there is an account I open in Mombasa illegally or privately to direct government money, by now everybody should have known if they have been in the paper. So these are just allegations and rumors.
Atipo says two committees formed to investigate accusations against him were since dissolved. He says a new one was formed after the last two found no evidence of a private account he allegedly opened in Kenya. He says even though his official documents, including a passport, have not been confiscated, he is being restricted from returning to Ghana to be with his family.
What is important for me now is just to, for them to finish whatever process they are going on so that I can travel. Because it has been a long time I traveled to see my family. So I think that's, for me, that is what is the most important to me now.
McQuay says
investigations, especially some things to do with finances and so forth, are not hastily done.
Atipo was appointed by President Salva Kiir last year. Some analysts have described his removal by Finance Minister Garang as illegal. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
Four people sustained severe injuries after a cargo plane crashed in Bor on Sunday. The director of the Bor airstrip says the South Sudan Aviation Authority has dispatched a team to Bor to investigate the crash. Deng Gai Deng has the details from Bor.
The Burundian pilot, Congolese co-pilot, and two Sudanese traders sustained broken legs, arms and ribs in the crash. The co-pilot suffered a broken spine, but there were no fatalities. Bor Municipality Mayor Maj Majer says the small cargo plane crashed about 12 kilometers south of Borhead Strip in Matok Village during bad weather.
The weather was really terrible. A LET L410 from Walgak going to Juba had crashed at that time. There were two passengers and a pilot and a co-pilot. So it went down, but these people were rescued by the locals. Immediately locals came in and they rescued them. When we got there, the four people were already rescued.
Borhe Port Director Kwod Jonakech says the two Sudanese traders hired the plane, pilot and co-pilot, to deliver goods from Juba to Walgak in Bia State.
The aircraft is damaged. Totally.
We actually did a small test that normally when any aircraft crash like this, we do alcohol test and drug test, and none is negative. But there is still fuel leakage in the area, in the top of the water, and in the grass.
Akechi is warning residents to stay away from the crash site because of leaking gasoline. Majer says the four survivors are being treated at the Animis Hospital in Bor.
We were able to use one ambulance from Animis and another ambulance from the Bor State Hospital to rescue them and bring them to the Animis Hospital, which is called Sri Lankan Level 2 Hospital. And they are there right now.
Majer says all four are expected to recover from their injuries. Burundian pilot Bizarra Lionet, whose ribs were broken in the crash, described what happened.
We got a message from Juba. They say the weather is going to deteriorate. We'll be back the next 10 minutes. So we decided to come back to land to Bor. But in Bor, the radio was not functioning. So we came by our own. And we found there was, again, a big thunderstorm here. And in that thunderstorm, we were destroyed.
A little over a year, 19 people were killed when a small passenger plane crashed into South Sudan's Lake Irul. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
UNICEF says more than 900,000 people in South Sudan have been affected by flooding, including 490,000 children. The United Nations Children's Organization also estimates that some 70,000 families have been displaced because of those floods. Mavis Otiengo has more from Washington.
Heavy flooding has devastated the nation since July, submerging entire communities and displacing hundreds of thousands of people. The most affected areas are the former states of Apanao, Rap, and northern Bahal al-Ghazal, Unity, Eastern Equatorial, and the Lake. Although rains are expected in South Sudan at this time of the year, the rains this year have been unusually heavy, and very large amounts of rain coming in at short time has caused the floods. Helene Sabu Rien, UNICEF spokesperson in South Sudan, says floods have limited people's access to health facilities, nutrition centers, and other basic necessities.
And the impact of these floodings are devastating because, for example, the health system in South Sudan is really fragile. And when people are exposed to shock after shock, their coping levels are going down. And this is why it's really devastating, and especially for children, because they don't have that resistance in their bodies to withstand, for example, the diseases that come with the flood water. We already see an uptick in malaria and acute watery diarrhea because of the rain.
She says many of the affected people already needed humanitarian aid before the flooding, with more than 60% of the population affected by floods facing malnutrition.
We will probably see an uptick in malnutrition rate next year. Already we had projected for next year 1.3 million children suffering from acute malnutrition, but we will probably see higher numbers because of the flood, because of acute watery diarrhea, and also because of malaria, because malaria is one of the reasons why children get malnourished.
Rien says over 88,000 children are currently out of school because of the floods. She says UNICEF has found that it is difficult to get children back to school once they are forced out by disaster. She says crops are failing and grazing lands have been submerged by floods. This is affecting food security across South Sudan, a country where Rianne says more than half of the population does not know where their next meal will come from. She says because UNICEF has already been working in the region, it is possible to scale up its response. The organization already provides hygiene kits, screen children for malnutrition, and offer immunization. However, she says because some roads have been cut, bridges damaged, it has been a big challenge to reach some flooded areas. Ryan says, though UNICEF secured $5.5 million to respond to immediate needs of women and children affected by the floods, the organization does not have enough funds for a full response. She appealed to the international community to enable UNICEF reach the most vulnerable people in flooded areas. Reporting for the VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Washington.
Sudan once had the largest railway network in Africa, with most of the train cars sourced from the United States. But decades of negligence, economic troubles, and U.S. sanctions have crippled the railway and made Sudan reliant on Chinese-made trains and parts that it can barely afford. After the ouster in April of former President Omar al-Bashir, the railway supporters are hoping the U.S. will soon lift sanctions to help restore Sudan's rail system to its former glory. Naba Mohideen reports for VOA from Khartoum.
65-year-old Mahdi Yassin has been working for the Sudan Railways Corporation since 1972. Yassin remembers the railway's glory days when it was the largest in Africa, running 5,000 kilometers, 3,100 miles from the Egyptian Red Sea and crisscrossing Sudan to what is now South Sudan. Yassin says Jebet School was graduating 100 students per year, all qualified to work on the railway. It was a strong corporation. There was abundance in spare parts and locomotives. But the railway fell apart through mismanagement and a fear of organized labor's influence on the economy and politics. Now, railway workshops in Sudan look like a graveyard, littered with dozens of vehicles, some of them idle for decades. Sudan fired thousands of qualified rail workers, replacing some with political appointees put in place after former President Omar al-Bashir came to power. Railway workers hope Bashir's ouster in April will encourage the United States to lift sanctions it imposed on Sudan for human rights abuses and harboring terrorists. Mahmoud Saleh is the director of engineers in Khartoum Train Workshop. Saleh says if the sanctions are lifted, they can at least be updated with the technology of the trains. Saleh adds that Sudan is so late to update the current technology. It's functioning with the past century's technology. They need to update and then develop. After the British colonial era, the state-run railway became reliant on U.S. trains and replacement parts. But because of sanctions, Khartoum has been unable to buy U.S. parts, leaving only 18 of the railway's 106 U.S.-made trains in service. Sudan Railways Corporation Director Muhammad Hamid said the railway turned to China to keep the trains running. Hamid says when the U.S. embargo cut out everything, they had to import their spare parts and needs from other countries. He adds that they restored to China. They have the American locomotives. And of course, China can't produce the American spare parts, especially the main machines from Caterpillar Inc. So what they were going to do? Importing a few Chinese trains in 2014 allowed Sudan to launch two new passenger lines, but poor track conditions means the trains can only go 60 kilometers per hour, half their maximum speed. Before Yassin retires at the end of this year, he hopes to see U.S. sanctions lifted and more efforts by Sudan's transitional government to get the country's railways back on track. Naba Mohideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Another reported wrongful death is being investigated at a hospital in Juba. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
who makes you happy? My family makes me happy, but mostly my aunt. She's called Aunt Percy. She makes me happy very much. She motivates me.
I personally, someone who understands me better, like, you know what I do, when I get happy, you know, and you can easily identify that I'm not happy with something. Yes, that is all that makes me happy.
Basically, me in my life, I love being with my family. I love being with people that I love, people that also love me. So when I'm around such kind of people, I feel very happy.
I'm happy when I'm spending time with my sisters. We are able to do fun stuff, like we cook together and we just spend a lot of time together, and I'm happy when I'm with them.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today we are discussing a disturbing string of child deaths reported at a Juba area hospital. A family in the capital says it will sue the Al-Sabah Children's Hospital after a 14-year-old child died last month at the facility. The hospital's director has admitted the hospital is responsible for that child's death and says they are working to resolve the matter with the bereaved family. Ding Magat has more for VOA from Juba.
A 42-year-old man who wants to remain anonymous to protect his privacy says he is filing a lawsuit against Al-Sabah Children's Hospital in Juba for injecting his niece with penicillin on the wrong part of her body. He says that on September the 24th, his niece went to Juba Teaching Hospital seeking treatment for pneumonia. He says she was referred to Al-Sabah Children's Hospital, where she was admitted for 3 days. The Juba man says his late niece was due to be discharged from Al-Sabah Hospital on September 27th because she had improved greatly. He says on the morning of 27th, an unnamed intern nurse at the hospital removed prescription papers and administered a benzathine penicillin injection on the patient's hand.
In a state of injecting to the right position, she just told the lady that you bring your hand. The lady told her that he is not always injected on the vein. It is supposed to be injected on the buttock. They quarreled, the mother came in. Then the mother told her that, you know, this drug is supposed to be injected on the buttock. So the nurse responded negatively, saying, if you knew what to do, then you were not supposed to bring your daughter to the hospital. But she persisted, she continued, asking the lady to bring her hand. The innocent girl gave her hand, and that is where she passed on within 3 minutes.
The deceased child's uncle says he got a phone call and rushed to the hospital, where he discovered his niece had already passed. According to the uncle, a post-mortem carried out by a pathologist at the military hospital in Juba confirmed the child died due to penicillin being administered to the hand.
That is when now I went to police, because you had to start with the attorney general. So I did not find the attorney general. I came back. Since it was better hot, I knew that if the body continued staying there, it might get spoiled. So I had to take the body to Juba military hospital.
He says the legal process took the entire second day, so he searched for a doctor to perform the post-mortem. The family was concerned the intern had not been apprehended and contacted the hospital. Dr. Felix Nyungura, acting executive director of Al-Sabah, says the hospital accepts responsibility for what happened and apologized to the family.
This was very unfortunate that it happened. We are sorry for it. What happened was that our child, who was the patient, was under care of the hospital. He was very stable. Unfortunately, he was given medication which is supposed to be given IM, was given IV.
Rachel Lual, a practicing lawyer and chairperson for the Coalition of Public Interest in the Republic of South Sudan, says a case of wrongful death falls under tort law, which deals with how to proceed in cases of suing an institution under 33 of Civil Procedure Act 2008.
The complainant should write immediately to the Minister of Justice, informing him of the, of the intention to sue certain government institution. For example, if it is the Ministry of Health, and then you put it clearly that you are intending to sue the Ministry of Health because of so and so. And then after 2 months, you can proceed with your case without any problem.
South Sudan Health Minister Dr. Riak Guy Cox says he is not aware of the incident, but says such cases are handled by the General Medical Council.
If there is such an incident, the competent body is the South Sudan General Medical Council. That is an autonomous body. It even regulates the practice of public health facilities like Juba Hospital, Sabah Hospital, even the doctors, including the private clinics. They are supervised and regulated by that body.
In their pursuit of justice, the family says it hopes the child's death and the resulting lawsuit will serve as a warning to doctors and other medical staff who wrongfully treat people in the country. This is not the first time a child's wrongful death was reported at Al-Sabah. In June, Peter Madol says he lost his 8-month-old boy who was diagnosed with sepsis at the hospital. A staff member reportedly switched off a generator powering the oxygen to support the baby's breathing. And a 32-year-old mother who preferred to be identified only as Irene for privacy reasons told South Sudan in Focus in May that she lost her baby who was diagnosed with malaria at Al-Sabah due to what she calls a lack of seriousness from the medical personnel. For VOA News, I am Ding Magot in Juba.
The governor of Budwe State is in the United States to talk about his efforts to build trust among the communities across his state. Daniel Badagbu says he is here in Washington, D.C. to share best practices for peace building in a post-war scenario. He's also promoting large-scale farming as one way of empowering young men and women to get involved in agriculture rather than joining rebel groups.
I've come actually to share experience at the learning event taking place here, organized by the International and the USAID, actually looking at the collaboration for resilience in Africa, comparing partnership in initiatives in stable-led and fragile states in the context of resilience and recovery. That's what is taking place here, and that's what I've come for, because we have started this resilience and recovery program in Budwe State after we attend the stable environment in the state. Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about the situation in Budwe State. We've been hearing a lot there. One complaint was the city SAM. During their annual report, there was a case where the city SAM said their monitors were harassed in Yambio, especially by the authorities there. Can you tell us about the activities, the peace activities in your area?
Totally, Sitsam, what they said is not true at all, because since we started what we call the local homegrown solutions to our homegrown problems in Budwe State, we are the only state, Budwe State, that has actually signed the peace with the rebels, who were the SSNLM, which was a local initiative that was done by the state government and the stakeholders, the churches who and the Islamic faith came together to mediate that. And we have never had any harassment actually to citizens at all. And also, we also gave the amnesty to the IO who are there. And as I'm talking, we are building trust and confidence with them.
Talk to us about resilient activities in the Budwe State. What are you doing there?
Actually, the resilience activities came as a result of after we made the local peace initiative there, we decided that what can we do to actually make the people of Budwe State to bounce back after the conflict, after moving through the shocks of war, what can we do to bring them back? And we decided decided to bring what we call resilience and recovery, which is actually gearing towards reducing vulnerabilities and enhancing coping capacities of our people. And within this resilience program, we decided to develop about four pillars, whereby one pillar is to rebuild trust in people and in institutions. And under this pillar, we have three agendas whereby we need to strengthen institution support, local mechanisms to restore trust. And then the second pillar is reestablishing access to basic services. And under this, we need to deliver life-saving humanitarian assistance through our partners to the people, and also restore access to education, health, and the wash. You remember, during times we have IDPs who ran away from their areas because of the conflict. And now, after we have achieved peace, we need to return these people to their areas. And to return them, we need to provide them with the access roads there. We need to restore operations in schools and health centers. We provide clean water for them so that they can live very well. The third pillar is actually to, which is what we call restore productive capacities of people. This is under the agenda of we need to increase productivity, production value of key agricultural commodities, and also to close skills and capacity gaps, vulnerabilities, especially for women and the youth, and to do rehabilitation to critical farm and market access. Within this, we need to, we are doing what we call women empowerment and youth empowerment, training those youth, because Johnny, we have released about 1,048 children who are associated with the armed group, and amongst them, when they are taking others to school and giving them vocational training centers so that to create stability in the area, and looking at entrepreneurship for the young people and the cooperative societies for the farmers so that people can cope up and reduce vulnerabilities. That's exactly what we are doing.
And that is Daniel Badagbu, governor of Budwe State. He was speaking from Washington via WhatsApp with my colleague John Tanza yesterday. And that is our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Anna Hibu by the musician Binia.
Nina kan masi kuwes kuwes muhabbat nina kan masi kuwes kuwes lokanina masofo bado gel batena magita la morta lokanana masofo hia gel batai magita la morta lakin wala tani jakabasu binia de karabula stomini wala tani jakabasu binia de Sabab kalamde, kuriyo, yamulu mushake. Asan kede ana sibu, sibu hiya lewelede. Asan kede ana sibu, sibu hiya lewelede. Binere abana galanam, maindu kuruzula dunu. Yana ibu ibu binia. Kamar mama ana ibu ibu binia bin banat belena mama ana ibu ibu binia iwala se kamar mama muhabbatenina kan masi kuwes kuwes muhabbatenina kan masi kuwes kuwes.
We've been listening to Benia performing the song Ana Hibu. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for being here. We hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
mucha general san kede yana sibu sibuya lewelede san kede yana sibu sibuya lewelede